Future Proof. Proudly supported by Science Foundation Ireland.
Hashtag believe in science.
Hello and welcome to Future Proof, the podcast. I'm Jonathan McRae, and this week we're in Cork. Yay! We're delighted to be here at the Blackrock Castle Observatory for this very special programme, because the International Space Studies programme is here in Cork for 9 weeks, and it is basically now a mecca for astronauts, businessmen and women, anyone who's interested in bringing our exploration of space a little bit further. So we're going to have a fantastic panel on space this week. We're also going to be looking at other parts of our experience. We're going to be looking at science that's done at the extremes of our planet, and also things we can do to help the native species that live on our planet as well. So we're going to be looking at the science of space, land and water on this week's programme. I'm really looking forward to hearing the audience's reaction to some of the really interesting comments that we get from our panel today of our world. But first, it's to our panel, and I'm really delighted to be joined by Robert Thirsk, retired Canadian Space Agency astronaut and a man who spent 204 days in orbit, Yi So-young, who's the first Korean woman to fly in space, and Dr. Niall Smith, head of Blackrock Castle Observatory and head of research at CIT here. And he basically is responsible for bringing the ISU Space Studies program here to Cork. You're all very welcome. Niall, why did you want to bring the Space Studies program here to Cork, and how much of a big deal is it?
Well, the global space industry is worth about 300 billion euros a year, and it's rising at about 5% per annum. And at the moment, Ireland maybe taps into about 80 million euros worth of that. So you can see it as a bit of a gap between the 80 million and the 300 billion. So one of the things that we thought is, because CIT works a lot with industry, and because we looked at what the global space industry needs, which is effectively every domain you can imagine, from food to ICT, high tech, low tech, medium tech, the whole gamut is required to either put people in space, put spacecraft in space, keep them there or whatever, or feed the people that keep them there and so forth. So we looked at that and we said, what's the best way that we can actually showcase to Irish companies the opportunity in the global space arena? And importantly, showcase to that global space arena what Irish companies are capable of doing. So you take, it's a twin-pronged attack. It's a push-pull. We have 207, you've two of them either side of me today. We've 207 visiting experts. I mean, this is unprecedented in Ireland. And that's an amazing opportunity for us to connect into that expertise, that knowledge. And by the end of the 9 weeks, then people have a much better idea of what Ireland can do, and people in Ireland have a much better idea of what it is an opportunity for them.
Yes, but when people think about space, they think about Chris Hadfield, you know, floating around in the International Space Station, or they think of the moon landings, but they don't generally tend to think of the business of space. And that, as you say, when you do a bit of research into it, like, there's space everything. There's space lawyers in Ireland, aren't there? There's people whose job it is to figure out who owns what in space.
Yeah, and this is a really interesting new area, because we're moving from an era when we kind of look, we go to the moon and then we come back and so on, to thinking, how do we exploit it? And I use the word exploit, hopefully in the most positive sense. But the question then becomes, for example, who owns it? What should we pay for it? Does space belong to everyone? If you land on an asteroid, for example, and you want to mine it for some precious metal that's really necessary to run the semiconductor industry, for example, should you own all of that? Who owns what? And the danger is that the countries who have the largest and most developed technologies then get to have a stranglehold on resources that, as a planet, we all need. So law, space law, now starts to say, well, let's see, how do we work together? Who can do what? And just because you have money shouldn't be the only determinant of whether or not you can use that resource.
I'm looking forward into the future. In, you know, 40 years' time, the reality TV show Space Court, you know, where the lawyers wearing sort of shiny spacesuits are like making arguments.
Yeah, we'll be sure you're one of the first up on those asteroids, Jonathan, as well.
Thanks, Noah. Robert, this is, this is an international endeavor, isn't it? Space exploration. It's interesting. We were talking about, you know, space law, the laws that govern space kind of say that this is an international place and that you can't own anything and you're not allowed to put weapons in there. But you might talk to us a little bit about the internationalism of space, and maybe take us through your career, because as an astronaut, you ended up sort of really negotiating the international relationship between astronauts, both while they're in space, and since you've come back down to Earth, it's a mad thing to say. Since you've come back down to Earth, maybe tell us a little bit about your career and how you became an astronaut and why that became sort of a speciality for you.
Well, I have to start with my childhood. A few minutes ago, you referred to space as the next frontier, the last frontier, an ability to inspire us. I was an elementary school child when the Apollo moon missions occurred, and those missions gripped me. Grabbed my attention, and of course millions of other young people as well. So I did decide that if I ever had the opportunity, I'd sure like to be able to work in space and have that as a career. I was Canadian. I am Canadian, and back then it was only Americans and Soviets or Russians that were flying in space. But that little seed of a dream got planted in the back of my brain, and eventually Canada, my country, was ready to have a program. I was fortunate to be selected. But you're absolutely right. You know, the perspective of the Earth from orbit is one of just, we're all together, humanity, and everyone in the world is connected. So for the first few days in orbit, you look down and you see your country. And then a few days after that, you look down and you don't see your country, you see your continent. And then a few days after that, you just see one world. And a good example was about a year ago, my wife and I were having dinner with another couple, and someone asked me, Bob, have you gone back to normal after your space flight? And I immediately answered yes, thinking bones have regained their calcium, muscles have regained their strength. And my wife said, no, you have not returned to normal. And of course, what she meant was psychologically, emotionally, whereas in the past, you know, I was concerned about municipal government affairs. I was concerned about taking the garbage out to the curb at
Bin charges, water charges. Yeah. We don't concern ourselves with those here in Ireland. It's not a big thing.
But now I'm worried about survival of humanity. You know, humanity will be here certainly 10 years from now, 100 years from now, maybe 1,000 years from now. Beyond that, just looking from the orbital perspective of what we're doing to our planet, I wouldn't bet on it. And then the other thing, too, is... you know, if some of our decision makers had the opportunity to go up in space and just look out the window, do nothing, just look out the window for 3 days, and you really get an idea of what is really important in life and the kind of decisions that they should actually be making and the kind of news media that we should actually be covering. It's more global. What's happening in the Sudan, in the South Sudan right now? What's happening in the Middle East? What's happening in North Korea? You see that so clearly from space flight. And I wish that all decision makers had that opportunity to look at that orbital perspective.
So you're saying it would be great if we could fire some politicians into space, essentially.
Now, I'm not as mean as you are, John.
You said, Bob.
I'm planning on bringing them back.
Yeah.
I was thinking that sort of global perspective, you can learn some ways, but that's probably one of the most spectacular ways to do it. So maybe you might talk to us about your experience, because being a female astronaut, presumably it was more difficult for you to have the opportunities internationally to get to get the training, to get the experience to get your first space flight. Can you talk to us about life in Korea and your career?
Many of people guess that maybe as a female would be more difficult and hard, but I did my best not to think in that way, because any job, any place, everybody has a hard time. And then in some point, because I'm a woman, it's a little more easier and then get through well and then better than others. In some case, and then because I'm a woman, sometimes it's a hard kind of thing. So I just want to take as it's kind of hard time or hard job and tough job for anyone. So not only as a mom always hard, but also as a father, you always have a hard time. So I just want to try to take that way.
Can I ask you what it was like when you found out that you did get chosen and that your male counterpart didn't? That phone call, was it a phone call? Was it a meeting? And how did that feel?
Some kind of gradual changing thing, because some of the Russian guys come to me and said, maybe you will fly rather than him. And then after for a while, Korean government said, we don't know yet. It means could be changing. And then finally, Korean government called me, please join the primary crew training. And it, wow, that's really cool. But in the same time, I had a huge burden on my shoulder. So frankly, I was not that excited at that moment, because as a Korean female who grew up in Korea, first, idea in my mind is, oh my God, so many guys would be enemy of mine because they blame me to make another guy down. So how can I deal it? And then next, oh my God, so many scandals and rumors and fake news going around. Why is changing and how I can deal it? And what if I made a mistake, even if I didn't mean to? Then maybe somebody blame me. Oh, because we send woman, we better send guys. And how I can deal that? So one of my friends asked me, what if you will be a primary? And then do you feel bad because you are backup? And then I told that either way, I can have some words starting with F. So if I became a backup, I would have a freedom, more freedom than fine. Him. But if I became a primary, I would have more fame than him. Either way, it's okay, not bad.
I thought you were going to say another F word. Yeah, I was going to say, this is not the right place for that. Maybe Korean radio is a lot more liberal. So that's really interesting because, yeah, I've been in that situation where you get some great news and you're like, oh no, now we have to do all that work. But yeah, so I can see how there's a big burden on that. Robert, would you talk to us a little bit about your first launch and what was that like? When did you first go into space? Because you hold the Canadian record for most days in space, 204 days
yes.
you spent in space. What was your first launch like? And was it everything you anticipated? Because they train the heck out of you guys, don't they? They really make sure that you know what you're doing before you actually get into that rocket.
My first flight was aboard the space shuttle Columbia, along with six wonderful crewmates from the United States and from France. And you're right, we spent months training in simulators before flight to go over all aspects of the upcoming mission. And the simulators are great, but like you were intimating, they cannot replicate what the real experience is. So let me tell you a little bit about what shuttle liftoff is like. 6 seconds before liftoff, the onboard computer sends a command to the three main engines to ignite. And they ignite, and there's a tremendous roar, a lot of shaking. Over the next 3 seconds, that computer checks to make sure that each of those three engines is operating correctly. And if they are, then at 0.3 of a second before liftoff, the two solid rocket boosters, they look like Roman candles, they ignite. And they immediately reach full thrust. And then at T equals zero, there's eight large hold-down bolts that are this size, about 20 centimeters in diameter. They explode, and there's now nothing hold the shuttle down to the launch pad and 7 million pounds lifting it up. So up we go. It's like a kick in the seat of the pants for us. I was naive. It was my first flight. I had put my emergency procedures checklist on a wall, Velcroed it on the wall in front of me, so if something terrible happened during ascent, I could look at my procedures, but they were moving back and forth like this. And it was impossible to read them. In 45 seconds, we've broken the sound barrier. In 2 minutes, we're 40 kilometers high, 40 kilometers offshore of the coast of Florida. We've used up all of the propellant in the two solid rocket boosters. There's no sense carrying empty rocket casings up to space, so we jettison the SRBs and they parachute back down to the Earth. And we begin the rest of the ascent on just...
What are you thinking through all this?
So I know why you're asking the question, because this is probably one of the riskiest things that human beings do. And so this could be the last thing that I ever do. Injury or death is always in the back of my mind. But you really have to focus. You have to focus on your task. There's things to monitor. There's switches to throw. There's valves to throw. So to maximize, you know, the success of the ascent, you've really got to be focused. Astronauts call this phenomenon compartmentalization. Yeah, the night before I said goodbye to my family. It might have been the last time I said goodbye, but you have to really focus on the task at hand. So it's all operational.
It's really difficult. I can't focus on the task even if I'm, you know, just driving a car. So I don't know how I would do it. I'd be like, woohoo! Woo! Yeah. Like yeah. The rest of the crew would be like, Jonathan, press the buttons. You need to be present. when you're up here, you obviously have to deal with people. And one of the things that you've really focused on in your career is international relations. Can you talk to us about how you get on, given there are such big cultural differences in space, and particularly with the background of, you know, the Cold War and now what's going on between America and Russia? Like, how does everyone get along?
Well, that's a good question. The first thing is you have to realize the cultural baggage that you are bringing into a multicultural crew. So I'm Canadian. There are certain things that I have perspectives, beliefs about, I don't know, universal healthcare, about a social security net, about how I drive. And I have to realize the baggage that I'm bringing in to a crew, and then understand the cultural background that they're bringing in as well. So that when traditions conflict, or when superstitions conflict, or when the way that we go about solving a problem conflict, we can understand where we're coming from.
Superstitions?
A lot of superstitions.
Soo Young.
You are superstition also, even if you cannot recognize it.
Oh, no, I know. Yeah, even though I hate it, I do still salute a magpie, even though I'm a total, you know, it's just something I do. I just salute.
Yeah, people pointing out some other people is superstitious because it's a stranger to them. But actually, every day, our daily life, we are doing a lot of superstitious things, but we are doing the unconsciously and then as a habit, so we didn't know. So when I arrived in Russia also, some military guys doesn't like women work with because it's very superstitious to have too many women in the one board would have some kind of cracking or thunderstorm kind of things. And then some navies still believe like that.
Yeah.
And then on the way back, actually in Soyuz capsule, we have two women and one guys. And then we had an accident. One of the high-rank military Russian guys in public with a radio interview or TV interview said that because of there's too much woman in there. And there was really, really uncomfortable, but also he grew up in that kind of environment. And then he take as is the law or regulation thing. So I'm trying to accept it, but still kind of uncomfortable. But in same time, I'm trying to in their own shoes, why they became like that. Because they want to be safe. They want to protect their own people. So we cannot blame that intention, even if they can say bad words. And I really want to follow their superstition because I also want to wish my own flight luck.
Yeah.
So.
But there's a problem with that, though.
Yeah,
you can't take everyone's superstitions on board. Otherwise, wearing lucky underwear, you know, you got a rabbit around your neck.
Right. And a lot of the soccer players and basketball players, boxers, they have their own kind of holy moment right before their own game. And a lot of Russian national also, on the way to go to the launch pad, we talked on the way come here, and they check everything before the launch and checked all the pressure on their own shirt. But only because Yuri Gagarin did a pee on the bus of tire of the bus. So all the astronauts take off the bus on the way to the launch, and they do pee on the tire.
What? Because Yuri Gagarin peed on the bus tire
on the way to the launch pad.
They all piss on the tire.
Yeah, all. Because they believe...
What about the lady Russian?
That's a good question. So I really... So I really want to follow that because I want to be one of the comrades of Russian military people. So I'm thinking right after being a primary crew, that was the biggest question of my mind. How can I do that? How can I do that? Because I really want to be one of their family, like a mafia. They always have a same kind of tattoo on their arms and kind of thing. It is the being a team. So, okay, I should do that. But I cannot do that because I'm a woman. I cannot take off a whole spacesuit right next to the bus. So I asked my flight surgeon, please bring the one little bottle of water. And he said, why? Because you already have water inside of the bus. Why are you worrying about the bottle of water? Please, just take it. And then he didn't ask me anymore. We don't want to make a diplomatic problem between the Korean government and Russian government. And then he brought it. And then, as I expect, bus was stopped in the middle of the nowhere in the Kazakhstan. And then all to my Russian national ready to take off the bus. I think, like, oh, that's the pee time. So I asked my surgeon, please give me back that bottle of water. And he said, why? Because I need it. And my commander working and engineer working, I was at the end, we just walking together and take off the bus. And then I'm in front of the bus door, and then one of the general hold me, where are you going, Soyeon? And I also want to do it with them, and they, oh, it's not the thing for you. And I know what they do. So for their privacy, I will do the pee other side of the bus. And he said, you cannot do that. And I have a bottle of water. So let me do just at least pretend, because I want to run up the team. But he said, it's too dangerous. So it's not for you, because you're a woman. So, but I take as the worrying, because what if I have some kind of accident or falling down or some kind of little bit of the problem, then it's not the problem between me and general. It will be the problem between the Korean government and Russian government.
Yeah.
So okay, I will take it, but I really, really want to do that. Yeah. So, but finally I couldn't do it. And then finally we arrived at the launch pad. And then when I stepped on the one stair, somebody kicked my butt. So, oh my God, what happened? I've never heard about that. But my commander, Sergei, told me, Soyeon, have you ever heard about this tradition? What tradition? So they said that in Russian family, if one of son or daughter has a long journey, in front of the door, they kick them to wish luck and a safe trip. So if because I'm a woman, I cannot pee on the tire. Even if I'm a woman, I should be kicked. But I take as an action, they really wish my safe trip. Yeah, they really. So
wow.
It is really interesting cultural difference, but I'm doing my best to take as a their own warm heart action.
That is very good of you. That is very kind of you. Wow, you've really extracted the best out of this entire scenario. But, you know, it really does get me thinking about because you think, when I think about the pressure of space, I think about what if something could go wrong. And I'm wondering, Robert, was there ever a time that you felt unsafe, either on ascent or in the space station or coming back in the Soyuz capsule, the Russian re-entry capsule?
Many. So as you were asking the question, I could think of like three different incidents, but coming home in a Soyuz vehicle, which is a capsule about 2.2 meters across with three people inside, is a wild, wild ride. It's like going over Niagara Falls in a barrel, but a barrel that's on fire. And there were moments where I looked over at my crewmates who had flown on Soyuz before and had this look in my eyes like, is this it? Is this the end of my life? And they just smiled and gave me the thumbs up. So yeah, there were moments. But Jonathan, there were other moments when I was on board the station and repairing equipment. There's a lot of life support equipment on the station that provides oxygen to breathe, that scrubs carbon dioxide out of the air, that recycles our perspiration and our urine for potable drinking water. And all of those machines failed. And I worked with the ground. And
at the same time?
No, so, thank God, over weeks or months period of time. But you know, before we send these young people off to Mars, we have to have more reliable, more robust life support equipment. So that's one of the engineering showstoppers right now, that we need more reliable technology.
So Young, you're really nodding your head there as if something.
Yeah, right. Because I even had a more harsher landing because one of my landing was one of notorious among the whole Soyuz flight.
Oh, really? Tell
yeah,
us
we
about
had
that.
An accident and we had a problem with the separation. So we should have a ballistic reentry. So we should have a more G than other guys who land with the Soyuz. But still, I was so surprised because oh my God, that's so reliable vehicle because I was luckily sitting the right seat and has a window. And I could see the flares higher than the 2,000, 3,000 degrees Celsius. But right after that, I touched the wall and, oh, it's not even warm. It's incredible technology as a point of view of an engineer. And that was really incredible.
That is so funny that through your mind as you're about to explode is the thought of, they did a pretty good job with the water in this guy. I wouldn't mind this in my home.
Yeah, right. And
it's
also,
AAA rating.
Yeah, actually, during my stay, we had a false alarm and a false alarm of the depressurization. But finally, I realized that I was so ignorant, even I had a training and fly when I watched the movie Gravity, because in the movie Gravity, they just showed and visualized us what happened during the depressurization. But during my training, I was a mechanical engineer, so I learned, what if we have a depressurization, maybe pressure going down and then everybody would be frozen or boiling your blood and all the scenarios I learned as a knowledge, as a text. But I've never think about as a personal. So when you go on the airplane, and always flight attendant said that when we had an emergency landing, you should have a life jacket and blah, blah, blah. Nobody listened to them carefully because you believe you will not have that. And you never visualization, you have a vest and take out the airplane until you face it, right? So when I watch the movie Gravity, oh my God, what if my depressurization false alarm was not the false? And I've never thought about it that way.
There was real depressurization, yeah, there was a false alarm.
Would it be I'm kind of frozen like them in the movie, or would it be like cool, killed it? I've never thought like that, even if I trained a lot of time. And then I cried and then trembling and then sweating, and then my husband poked me. Are you okay? What happened? Because we are in the middle of the cinema.
Wait, hang on a second. So as a trained astronaut who beat 36,000 other people to get into space, the first time you thought about the bad things that could happen to you in space was while watching Gravity.
Because I was so busy, I was so focused, I would never think about that situation with a layback. Bob told that we were so focused, so we didn't have any spare brain to think about that thing in personal. So that was a really interesting experience for me, yeah.
Is that something you train people to do, Bob? I mean, do you train people to not think about that, or, you know?
There's a number of things that we train for. So we spend maybe hundreds of hours during our training in simulators training for good days in space. But Jonathan, we spend thousands of hours training for bad days in space. So depressurizations, fires, toxic atmospheres. But there are some things for space flight that there's no way you can survive. Mm-hmm. So for example, I talked about a shuttle launch. If one of those SRBs, solid rocket boosters, does not ignite, you're going to be dead in 5 seconds. Mm-hmm. There's nothing you can do about it. Mm-hmm. So you don't train for that. You can just get it out of your mind. It's, again, compartmentalization or blockage for those things that, that you have no chance of surviving, and it's just your service to the to human spaceflight. And if you can just indulge me, you know, a lot of people would never want to become an astronaut. Mm-hmm. And before I became an astronaut, had to decide whether or not the risks of injury and death outweighed the opportunity to represent my country in space, to work with incredible people, to work with top-level organizations like the Canadian Space Agency and NASA, and then to do something that was a childhood dream. And for me, the decision I made was, you know, the benefits greatly outweighed the disadvantages. Not everyone makes that decision. Space flight is tough. It's hard to build equipment and hardware that operates in the harsh environment of space. It's tough to take care of the well-being of astronauts in space. But for me, I decided it's worth it.
I have to say, I'm delighted that you both made it back home safely. And and we were delighted to have you here on the program. Please give a really warm round of applause for Robert Thirst, Yi Song Yong, and Dr. Niall Smith. This is Future Proof. We are at the Blackrock Castle Observatory.
Future Proof. Proudly supported by Science Foundation Ireland.
Hashtag believe in science.
Welcome back to Future Proof on News Talk 106 to 108. We're in Cork! We are at the Blackrock Castle Observatory, where the International Space Studies Programme is taking place. 9 weeks of events where businesses and budding astronauts could come here, learn about the potential for space. And alongside that, there's an amazing summer of space program that's been put on by the Blackrock Castle of Observatory. If you'd like to find out more, ssp17.ie or bco.ie. Amazing events, panel talks, interactive exhibitions, and so on. Now, hard act to follow, I have to say, for our next two guests. But you can't come to Cork without visiting Photo Wildlife Park. And I was here only a few months ago, and really enjoyed my time there and was completely unaware of the native species program that they run. So I'm delighted to be joined by John McLaughlin, who's assistant head warden here, and Linda McSween, who's head of education. You're both very welcome. Perhaps you might start off, John, by telling us a little bit about the native species program that happens in Photo, because you have all these fantastic non-native animals in the park, but you also are doing some work to try and protect the species that we have here in Ireland.
The two programs we work mostly with are the Natterjack toad, which is a Kerry native, and then the corncrake, which is very rare now in Ireland. Donegal is pretty well the last stronghold for it. Now, the corncrake project, it's a slow runner. There's a lot of work being done with the national parks in conjunction. This was the first year we basically got permission to take some eggs from the wild if they were from nests that were threatened. Sorry.
Yeah, no, don't worry. We can edit this out.
Yeah.
It's the magic of pre-recording.
Of radio. Yeah. So basically, we were waiting for eggs this year. We were ready. But for the last 5 years, what we've been doing, we got some birds from Germany. And we've basically been learning the husbandry skills necessary to raise them in captivity.
What is the husbandry skills of a coin? Like, what do you have to do to get the eggs?
There's diet. There's picking the males and females that, you know, the male has a distinctive call. It's how they assess them in the wild. They count the number of males calling.
What's the call sound like?
What's it sound like? Well, it's as the name corncrake. It's, you know, a crack crack is the...
Come on, you can do a good impersonation, John. Come on. Who wants to hear John do an impersonation?
I can't, but I wondered, if I had been thinking, I would have recorded it for you this morning, but it would probably mess it up. It's very loud. It's very distinctive. And if you're at photo wandering around, if you're in our new Asian sanctuary, usually in the morning, you can hear them in the background if you knew what you were listening to. Most people are just so fascinated.
If only there were a way that we might know what we were listening for.
I know.
Go on, give us a rough approximation.
It's just creek. It's creek creek. Is
creek
all
creek.
It is. It's
creek
all,
creek.
Yeah.
Okay. How many of these birds are left in the wild, and why are they depleting in Ireland?
I don't know what the recent assessment is. You on the corn crickets?
As far as I know, it's less than 250 individuals, so it's really close to becoming extinct at the present moment in time. And I suppose the biggest problem is the lack of suitable breeding grounds in the wild for them. And more importantly, an exceptionally unusual behavioural trait that John will mention as well, that perhaps most people aren't aware of, that limits them from being released in photo at the moment. So John, I'm sure, will fill you in relation to what those limitations are.
Well, I just carry on with what we're saying. The other problem is on predators. Mink is a big problem. They're a small bird. I have a little...
We have a stuffed
one here.
Corncrake here.
So they're a very small bird. They breed in on the ground, and they're prone to predation. Mink is a big problem, but then even feral cats and things like that will happily take, especially the chicks. Chicks are very tiny, little black. They look.
So this it's not human reasons why it's become endangered.
Well, the humans also play a role. Agricultural practices, again, they nest in grassland. So our change from the older ways of just waiting for hay and cutting them, you know, late. Now with all the silage, it's a much earlier cut. So you'd be cutting with these big machines at the same time when they'd be nesting.
So habitat loss is a big problem. Okay.
Yeah, just a bit of a conflict. Now, we don't know. They also migrate all the way to sort of South Africa or Sub-Saharan anyway. We don't know what happens to them there. There hasn't been enough study to see whether part of our number decline is... due to what's happening in Africa as well.
Are they, because when we describe endangered species, they're like these funny terms that they have. Whereabouts are they in terms of the endangered scale?
On a European level, they're just endangered. In some places, they're not endangered at all. I mean, I think in France,
there's varying degrees of endangered, isn't there?
There is.
Linda, there's like...
There would be, according to the convention... effectively, according to CITES, there can be anything from threatened, they can be endangered, critically endangered, and the most recent addition to that list, sadly, in the last 10 years or so, is now what we refer to as EW, which means that they're extinct in the wild. And that's the biggest problem that we're currently facing with the vast majority of faunal species that we currently hold in photo, is that captive populations effectively is all that exists for them. And probably additional problems that the corncrake is facing, like John touched upon, is that mechanization of farms has become hugely problematic, intensification likewise. But perhaps it's down to their own unique behavioural patterns, whereby they are ground nesters, which doesn't appear to make a lot of sense in evolutionary terms for this specific species, certainly from the point of view of escaping predators. But what tends to happen is that they tend to nest towards the centre of a field. And in the olden days, whereby silage or hay was taken by hand using a scythe, for example, heavy machinery, mechanization has effectively now led to practices changing, whereby fields are being harvested from the outside in. And these birds need long grass in order to facilitate escape. They can fly, but for some reason, they choose not to.
Are these birds just dying to be extinct?
I'm beginning to think that perhaps they're not the smartest, Jonathan. aesthetically, they're very pleasing in terms of intellect level. Then it may leave quite a lot to be desired.
But they have evolved amazing behaviours, haven't they?
Yes.
In terms of figuring out where they are in the world, which also makes it quite difficult to reintroduce
introduce them. Can you talk to us a little bit about that?
The biggest problem is that as soon as the chicks hatch, the first night sky that they actually see is effectively what they use to navigate to their overwintering grounds in South Africa. They return to exactly the same breeding grounds in Ireland the following year. And of course, the problem for us is that if we were to allow that behaviour to take place in captivity, FOTA doesn't have a suitable breeding ground for them. So at the moment, in terms of our husbandry techniques, the vast majority of birds that hatch, they're actually held indoors until a definite breeding location or a suitable release site is actually found for them. And we're collaborating with the National Parks and Wildlife Service on that. So there's quite a lot of intensive scientific research ongoing to hopefully facilitate the release of those birds in the coming years as well.
Is that unique to birds to be able to sort of take a snapshot of the sky and know where they are?
I wouldn't think so. I would say that there's probably a number of species. John would probably be more knowledgeable in relation to that than I would, but it's certainly unique to an indigenous species.
Yeah, it is. It happens. It's just not that common, and especially the moon, like the night sky, being the other birds would maybe focus on landmarks and what they can visually see during the day for their flight patterns. But they figured this out had to be the night sky because in the wild, the parents actually, like I said to you, they migrate to Africa and then they come back to the same spot every year. But what they discovered is the parents actually leave. They might leave early September and head to Africa, where the chicks often will hang around for another couple of weeks, getting a bit stronger, molting a bit more, and head off. So they don't have parents flying with them. They just instinctively know where to go and where to come back. And that's how they decided that it had to be the night sky was what they were focused on.
One of the problems with also rewilding these species is they're pretty good at hiding, is it not? I mean, they're quite difficult to find because it's long grass, small bird.
Yeah, they're very hard to find. Now, we have them in our breeding pens are about 3 meters by 3 meters. And even though we know there's a pair in there and we know they're calling, you can see the breeding behavior going on, it sometimes takes hours to find where in that little patch where they've actually, because they just,
what?
I mean, they just blend. When she flattens down in a bit of long grass, she doesn't move. You can almost step on her and she won't move, which is why the machines, the tractors and stuff drive
this
over them.
This is a dumb bird. This is a really, I mean, I love animals. I like almost every type of animal. There's some animals I don't like, but mostly I like every, this is a really dumb bird.
Yeah,
well, but beautiful. He says, like, trying to claw that back. Tell us a little bit about the natterjack toad, because this is another endangered species. The reason I was saying is they have these funny terms. They kind of grade them as, like, somewhat endangered or mildly endangered, or I wouldn't want to be a natterjack toad type of endangered. They have these kind of strange terms. Tell us a little bit about the natterjack toad and why it's important and how endangered it is. In Ireland?
In Ireland, it's, I suppose you would just say critically endangered by number-wise.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. But it's only really found around the Dingle Bay, in the Kerry areas.
And so what are you doing at FOTA, Linda?
We have a number of captive populations of them at the moment. We, along with the National Parks and Wildlife Service yet again, we have very, very strong affiliations with those. We have removed, by licence, a significant number of individuals' tadpoles from the wild. We've also reared those in FOTA Wildlife Park. And now we're in a situation where I think John will probably confirm that we have hundreds that have been successfully reared there in the last few months. What he may not probably mention to you is the education department in FOTA, its contribution. Because within the last 6 months, John and Will, who would be our head warden, have actually set up a captive breeding project for flies, Drosophila, fruit flies mainly, which have taken over all the offices. So I think it's something that when they return to the wild, there should be a plaque to me.
Why would you breed flies? Like, they're easy to find. Put a chicken out in the sun for a week, you got some flies.
Jonathan, during the cold winter months, being ectothermic, you probably won't find too many of them out and about. So it's a case of, we have bred them in the offices. They've bred in significantly large numbers, let me say it. We also have probably a tropical temperature of around 28 degrees there during the winter months, which also is obviously welcomed by the staff there. So it's a case of,
they're not actually just buzzing around your office, are they?
Well, sadly, they have been. There have been a number of escapes.
They're short-lived, though.
Yeah, short-lived. That's the only thing. But the problem is they breed so quickly, they're replaced by others over a relatively short period of time. But it's great to see how nature works, let it be said. So we're sustainable in terms of our feeding practices. We breed our own.
John, we want to finish up on your recent training, because as part of a ranger warden, you have to be able to deal with the unexpected. So you went rifle training recently.
I did, yes.
Yeah, what's that? What's that for?
That's just, I suppose, part of health and safety. I mean, we do have large, dangerous animals at FODA, and it's our responsibility to make sure that if, which there probably won't ever be, but if there was a problem, that we could deal with it, really, to keep the public safe.
So, I mean, do you train with darts? Do you train with actual bullets? Do they stuff a bison or something and mechanically run it towards you like a rabbit at a race course? Or how does it work?
It's mostly target practice.
I see. Okay.
Is what it is.
how good a shot are you?
Not bad.
Okay.
You'd be safe enough.
I don't like rifles. If I was ever trained to use a gun, I want a gun that I was to be able to spin around on my finger and blow the smoke off the nozzle. It's the only type of gun I want, and I'd probably spend more time practicing that than actually shooting it. Big round of applause, please, for our guests, John McLaughlin and Linda McSweeney from FODA Wildlife Park. Thank you. Thanks very much, guys. For time, we're going to move on to our next guest, because I know you've all committed to being an hour and we've gone way over with the space program. So we're going to move on to our next part, if that's okay. So John and Linda, thank you very much. And big round of applause to you guys again. Thank you.
Future Proof. Proudly supported by Science Foundation Ireland.
Hashtag believe in science.
You're very welcome back to Future Proof on News Talk 106 to 108. We are in the Blackrock Castle Observatory as part of the Summer of Space events program. We're broadcasting from here. We've heard from astronauts in space, and now we're going to hear from scientists at the other extreme, the polar cap. So we're joined here by Kian Luck, who is a PhD candidate at the Maray Centre in UCC, and Dr. Jessamine Fairfield, a good friend and regular contributor, who's just back from 3 weeks on a boat in Svalbard. You're both very welcome. Round of applause for our guests, please. So, Jess, you have, this is an amazing program. You went basically to explore your artistic side in the Arctic Circle. Tell us about the program and what you went and what you did.
Yeah, so I've just come back from this science art residency in the Arctic Circle in Svalbard, which is kind of the islands just north of Norway. It's a Norwegian territory. And I went with a cohort of other scientists and artists. So I was there as a physicist, there were biologists, a marine scientist, and then also artists of all stripes.
Mimes?
There were no mimes, but there was a circus.
Not artists of all stripes.
We did have a circus performer and aerialist.
You did not.
We did. And what was amazing, she brought this frayed rope for like aerial stuff, which initially I was like, oh, that's cool. But like, are you really going to put that up on the mast? Like, that sounds insane. But a few days into the expedition, we actually anchored our sailing vessel to some ice at about 80 degrees north. You can just drill poles down into the ice, throw some ropes from the ship. It seems like a terrible idea, but they let us then go out on the ice from there. We had this rope hanging down from the mast, and then we all did sort of aerial lessons, and we're just hanging from this rope over the ice. Nobody died. It was amazing.
That's always good on an expedition to come out with the same amount of people as you started with.
Exactly.
So Wobak, you all went on this expedition for what, like a party, or like what was the point of it?
Well, we all kind of had different purposes going in. We had all pitched projects to the Arctic Circle organization that brought us together. But the idea was both to think about science and exploration in the Arctic, to think about artistic modes of representation of the Arctic, how to convey that experience to people who haven't been there, which is really difficult. And then also the Arctic is kind of a nexus of political forces, of climate change. You know, it's famously being extremely affected by all of the stuff that we as humans are doing, even though it's extremely far from where we as humans live. You know, so we saw glaciers that had just receded so much in recent decades that like islands and things were revealed that had never been seen before. These glaciers just sort of calving and shrinking at incredible rates. Calving.
What's a calving? Calving. What's calving?
So it's basically when the edge of a glacier is warming up, huge chunks of it just fall off into the sea if it's sort of ending at the sea.
Oh, calving. Is that what it's called? Yeah. Calving. Like,
yeah, like a cow
has a
giving
baby.
Birth. Yeah. And it's incredible because it makes this like really loud, almost gunshot-like sound.
I thought that was something you would only see if you were, you know, if you were staying, you know, David Attenborough style, you know, at the side of a boat for 3 months waiting for that. You saw that actually happen.
Yeah, some glaciers are extremely active. And so we would go around with the ship and we would just kind of stop places, get out, look around. People would work on their various projects. I was collecting glacier ice for a detector that I was building, and I needed really, really clear ice. We would just sit there by the glacier, and you would just see, like, you would hear a really loud sound, look, and then see just this huge piece of ice, like incredibly blue because it's so, so clear and sort of so pure, just falling off into the water. Sometimes several bits, sort of several waves of the glacier calving. And then you see this enormous wave start coming towards you. And a couple of times this happened when we were out in these really small boats called Zodiacs, just looking around at the different ice. And it would always be like, oh, no, turn around. But it was incredible, like such a huge experience. And our goal as scientists and as artists was to both to do some specific studies around that and to think about how to convey that to others. And especially because the Arctic is such a sensitive region, like it's a very fragile ecosystem. It has no light in the winter. And then an incredible, almost oppressive amount of light in the summer. The ecosystem and the plants and animals that live there are sensitive so much to external forces, specifically all of the change that we're causing in other parts of the world. So how to get people to think about that and how to potentially take action.
Well, yours is just a 3-week jaunt. Cian spent, over a year?
Bit longer. So a year and a half, 18 months, and I was working with the British Antarctic Survey. So I was on a place called Bird Island. So if you go from the south tip of South America east, you'll get to the Falkland Islands, and then another 1,000 kilometers southeast and you'll get to Bird Island. And it's only 5 kilometers long and with a human population of between 4 and 10. So,
so you spent a year and a half with between 4 and 10 people on a 5 kilometer wide island. And were there other inhabitants in that island that were non-human?
An endless supply. So our base was on the beach, and then surrounded by the beach, we had about 5,000 breeding Antarctic fur seals. And then you go up the hill, we had 10% of the world's wandering albatross. And then you go to the other side of the island, and you're surrounded by 80,000 macaroni penguins.
And I have not heard of macaroni penguins.
They're incredible. They're incredible animals. And this is actually the second biggest colony in the world. We call it Big Mac. And you you get to this colony, and the first thing that hits you is the sound. And then the second thing that hits you very fast is the smell. And then what our job to do some days was we'd have to go down to the very bottom of this colony and catch 100 penguins and weigh them so we could get weights as they're coming back from sea. But these animals are cute. They look really cuddly. They're about a foot tall. They look like a little teddy bear. But I've never met a more rage-filled animal in my life. And you'd pick one up, and it was like being in a fight that you very quickly lost. So
what would it do? Peck you or like?
Thankfully, they wouldn't peck, but what they would instinctively do is you pick them up and they would slap you again and again and again on your hand. And they had their flippers are rigid as rulers. So it's like, I don't know, if you were a bold child in school being slapped 10 times a second on your hand, and then all of a sudden your hand has gone numb and this penguin's running away and you have to try and catch another one.
Sounds like a great job. Was that in the job description when you signed up for a year and a half?
I think they sprung that one out.
So take us through a day. Like, what would you do every single day?
Quite a lot is the quick answer. But so I'd get up in the morning and then I'd walk to my study beach. But to get to my study beach, I'd have to walk through said 5,000 territorial breeding fur seals. So A, I had to walk very, very quickly, and B, I had to carry a broom handle with me at all times to hold them back. And then
are seals. Are seals dangerous?
They can be. Yeah, I mean these territorial male fur seals now, they could get up to a few hundred kilograms, and again, full of rage. they're the smallest of the fur seal family, but they're also known as the most aggressive. So I guess small dogs kind of syndrome.
Who picked this island?
Usually they're more show than anything else. So if you just tickle their whiskers or give them a gentle poke, they'll kind of run away. But yeah, that was a good bit of adrenaline in the morning. Then I get to the beach. I do all kinds of science, catching, tagging, weighing, measuring, counting, endless counting. And then we'd go off, maybe work with the penguins, work with the albatross. In winter, one of my jobs would be we would have leopard seals arriving. And leopard seals are really cool. They're 3 meters long. They're top predators. You'll see them catching seals, penguins, ripping them to pieces. Really ferocious animals. But my job would be to find them when they were sleeping and sneak up gently, 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 and try and give them a flipper tag and then run away really fast. And they're very light sleepers, so I had to run very, very fast.
Did you at any point ask the British Antarctic Survey, what happened to Bob, the guy who used to do this job?
Yeah, we used to joke that after a year and a half, you never went home. You just disappeared somewhere in the island.
So, like, what happened? Because if there's only, you know, four or five people on the island, are you all medical doctors? Like, what happens if one of these seals did actually bite you?
Yeah, so we're such a small team that we didn't have enough space for doctors and kind of IT specialists. We all had to double up on training. So I was like the designated medical expert. I don't know how that happened. And so we
what sort of training do you have?
I got about a week's training in a hospital of like advanced life saving and stuff, but okay. Thankfully never had to use it in anger. But we would have to practice on each other. So I remember we'd be sat around the kitchen table practicing putting like cannulas and lines into each other. But
really?
Yeah. Just as your evening entertainment.
So what happens if you do get bitten by one of these? What's the medical treatment for being bitten by so a leopard seal?
We had an emergency seal bite kit, and like seals have notoriously dirty mouths, so it's full of all kinds of bacteria. So the infection can be quite serious. So in this emergency seal bite kit, the two main ingredients are bleach and a toothbrush. So for that and many, many reasons, you try very, very hard not to get bitten by any seals, which was unfortunate, seeing as it was my job to grab these seals on a regular basis.
How do you run on ice?
Sorry?
You said you had to tag them and then run away. How do you run on ice?
Well, you had spikes, but it's not graceful, I can tell you that.
Did you see any animals when you were on your trip?
Yeah, we saw loads of animals, like a lot of seals, a lot of different types of birds. But we had a few polar bear encounters as well.
Oh, wow.
Which was first thrilling from a distance and then overly thrilling from a smaller distance. There was a bit of an incident where we kind of had made a landing, had split up into two groups to go for hikes. And every time that we kind of got off the ship, we had guides who all had rifles, all were trained in how to use them, because there's quite a few bears in Svalbard. And they're very curious, and they can be very dangerous. Their walking speed is about as fast as we would run, and they're extremely fast swimmers, and they really want to know what's happening around them. So
they're curious and hungry animals, I've heard, polar bears.
Yeah, I mean, I think most of the time they wouldn't be that dangerous to people, but you don't really know that until they've gotten very close. And so we'd split into these two groups, and the ship, actually, the lookout on the ship was the first person to spot a bear, and we kind of all hear it over the radios. And this bear just like booked it towards one of the hiking groups, not the one that I was in, fortunately, but we had all stopped and were like looking across this glacier to the other group, and the bear just like heading straight for them, swimming across this and like very quickly cut them off from their life vests.
And you were like, where's my iPhone? I got to film this.
Well, yeah, like everyone was both horrified and also like, best angle. What's the best angle? Oh, why don't I have more zoom? But fortunately, the small boat that they had been dropped off on the shore in was still in the water, so the captain was able to swing back around, pick up the life vests kind of behind the bear, and then go around it. Everyone had to slide down this really steep kind of hill to get to the sea, to get into the boat really quickly. And the bear, within minutes, was right where they had been standing, like smelling the air and like looking out to them, which was very intense. And at that point, everyone's like, aha, we're on the ship now, and started taking pictures.
What do people really learn from that? I mean, it sounds amazing, but like when a scientist, because sometimes I kind of wonder about the interaction between science and art, and you see, you know, this a ballet inspired by, you know, nanoparticles interacting with non-ionizing materials.
That is literally going to happen later this year.
What?
That's one of my collaborations that came out
of
this trip.
Oh, these are great.
Trip.
These are really good ideas. This is really awkward, Jessica.
Thank you.
Are you kidding?
No, I'm not kidding at all, because my roommate was a choreographer.
So you're going to do a ballet version of this?
It might be contemporary dance. Okay. I hope that that's all right
but
with
what,
you.
But what do we get out of that? I mean, very, very seriously, because the Arts Council fund this and Science Foundation Ireland fund, you know, these sort of art collaborations. Why are they important?
Well, I think one of the main reasons that this specific one is important is climate change. I think the Arctic is an incredible environment. It's a beautiful environment, but it also very uniquely drives home how we are changing the environment around us and the planet around us. I really appreciated hearing, you know, from the astronauts earlier how they kind of look down at the Earth and see how everything is connected. And I think that that's something that you see in the Arctic as well, how these different ecosystems, which initially, you know, in the past we thought, oh, the ocean will just give us like as many fish and as many whales as we want. That's great. Thanks, ocean. And now we're kind of realizing, oh, you know, these supplies are limited. These resources are limited. We're warming things. We're changing things. We're acidifying the ocean. We have a responsibility to think about what we're doing and why, and to think about the kind of Earth that we're leaving for our children.
And I think bringing people who see the world differently and artists who communicate in different ways, because we haven't nailed this communication of climate change, have we? Because we haven't, because there's still some people in the world who believe it didn't happen, it's not happening. And so we do need, I suppose, to think of different ways of communicating, and perhaps getting artists to do that is one way of doing it. Keen, maybe you might talk to us about, you know, when, because 3 weeks, you imagine it's too short, but when you're there for a year and a half, you must get pretty bored. Tell us about the film festival that you ran between the various bases at the Antarctic Survey.
So this is really when my family started to wonder about my sanity. But so it's a long running tradition actually that between all the different Antarctic bases, not just the British ones, but the American ones, the Australians, all the countries that have bases down there, we have this 48-hour film festival, where in the depths of winter we're given one weekend to film, shoot, and edit a film from start to end. We all upload it to a central server, and we download these films, then we vote on them, like kind of like an Antarctic Oscars. So, and it's very funny, like the British ones are always complete slapstick, the French are always very kind of with very French films,
very philosophical. Dream sequence,
but for our film, we did a 5-minute take on Lord of the Rings Comes to Bird Island. So I was totally against it, I wasn't up for it, but then the night before we made our costumes, and suddenly I was wearing the dinner cloth as a cape, and yeah, I got totally excited. And we entered, and somehow we won best acting for our efforts, and yeah, but without zero explanation, suddenly my friends and family saw pictures of me dressed as Legolas with a big wig running around the hills, and I just got a lot of concerned emails. Is everything okay, Keane?
I mean, like, because being out there for so long on your own and not seeing that many people must be kind of weird. And you know, people saying, are you okay? When you come back, is it... weird to be around like this? This would be a lot of people for you.
Yes, absolutely. So it's a question I meant to ask the astronauts earlier. They must have gone through something similar, but I know when I came back, I hadn't used my phone for a year and a half, I hadn't touched my wallet, cars were new to me, crossing the road again, I had to get used to all that. But I remember after a week, I went to Slane Castle to see the Foo Fighters play.
Whoa.
Yeah, that was really jumping in the deep end. And suddenly surrounded by 80,000 people. And my friend turned to me, kind of saw the whites of my eyes and the panic. And he said, just pretend they're all penguins. And I can deal with 80,000 penguins, no problem.
You and the penguins were close though, right? I mean, you'd wake up and they'd be in the base.
Oh, well, yeah. So we had to be careful. So as I said, our base was on the beach and we couldn't leave the doors open too long. If we left the kitchen door open, you could easily have a small group of seal pups walking around causing mischief. And the penguins used to come up from the water every evening and go for like this little group walk around the base. So you had to keep the doors closed at all times.
Big round of applause, please, for our guests. Keane Lux is from Murray Centre, UCC, and Jessamy Fairfield is from NUI Galway. If you like what you heard, don't forget to check out Bright Club. Brightclub.ie is the website, and you can see a programme of events for Cork and Dublin for Bright Club. Can you want to give some dates, Jess?
Yeah, I think July 11th, we're having a Bright Club, which is the kind of research science comedy variety night. July 11th in Dublin and July 12th in Cork.
Another round of applause for our guests. Thanks very much, guys. Thank you very much to our audience, to the Blackrock Castle Observatory, bco.ie or ssp17.ie if you want to find out more about the Summer of Space events. There's so many great things going on here in Cork. You're absolutely spoiled for choice. Thanks also to all of the staff working here, to producer Claire Darmody, Rona Brannock, who was researching, and Paul Buckland, who was on sound. That's it from us for this week. Thank you.
Future Proof, proudly supported by Science Foundation Ireland.
#BelieveInScience.